Set for oral argument this morning, Johnstown versus Larson, it appears council are present and ready.
We are ready, Your Honor.
Very good. For those of you who have not argued here before, let me briefly review the ground rules. This case is set for 15 minutes per side. The appellant may reserve whatever part of the 15 minutes you wish for rebuttal. You'll be guided by a lighting system which works as follows. When your time begins, the green light comes on. When 10 minutes have expired, the amber light comes on. And when your full 15 minutes have expired, the red light comes on. You'll be helped by a clock on the podium which counts backwards from 15, so you'll know how much time you have left. We've read the briefs in your case. We're familiar with the facts as you set them forth, so to the extent you wish to proceed directly to your legal argument and skip recitation of the facts, that's fine with us. However, the case is yours to argue as you wish. We would ask you to stay close to the podium, please. Because we're recording your arguments, we find it helpful to go back and listen to them occasionally again. And if you stray from the podium, your voice will not be picked up well by the recording system. Also be aware that the arguments are available over the internet within a few days following today's argument. So if there's anything of a confidential nature you don't wish to have out there, be guided by that accordingly. Feel free to adjust that podium by the use of a toggle switch. It goes up and down. Hopefully it works this morning, sometimes it doesn't. Finally, if anybody has a cell phone or a pager or other electronic device, please ensure it's turned off at this point. We're ready for argument.
Good morning. Please court. The name is Daniel W. Dean, attorney registration number 6744 out of Fort Collins. On behalf of the property owners, the respondents in the condemnation action, and appellants in this court. Your rules gave me 9,500 words to try to explain to you the injustices that rose out of the district court. I've done my best with those 9,500 words, and I actually don't have new legal argument for you to consider at today's oral argument. I do wish to emphasize a couple of rather critical factual elements of this case which are not in dispute. This case is brought primarily on the argument of good faith, negotiation prior to condemnation power. There are evidentiary issues which the trial court ruled on, which you are bound to say were within the discretion of the court and sustain the trial court on that level until you consider this good faith issue.
Mr. Dean, would you characterize the good faith issue as a question of fact or a question of law?
My opinion is that this case represents a good faith as a matter of law. And I want to point to you two undisputed factual circumstances in this case. The first is that the condemning authority claims good faith by having offered $44,363 when its petition said that the interest it was claiming was worth $50,000. And how is an offer of $44,000 good faith when they say that the property is worth $50,000? Because of that, I think issue good faith is a legal question. It hasn't been demonstrated in this case. Secondly.
Well, before you move on, Mr. Dean, there was some change in the description of the interest being taken from the time it commenced to the time of the actual hearing. It went from an exclusive easement to a non-exclusive easement that was underground. Doesn't that justify the difference in the amount that you say is different between the petition and the amount deposited or offered?
If they had ever offered the $50,000 for the expanded easement, I would yield to that argument. But they only offered the $44,000 for the full exclusive utility easement, which the property owner could not deliver, was unwilling to deliver, and the town didn't need.
So is there an obligation on the part of the property owner to respond to the offer and say, look, you've asked for an exclusive easement, I can't give that to you. You've mentioned $50,000 in your petition, but your revised final offer is $44,000. None of that happened, did it?
You have the fact pattern reversed. The final offer was before the petition, but yes, that did happen. Is it supported by the record? I don't think it is, because I don't think the communications of the negotiation following the original demand are part of the exhibits. because that wasn't the issue at the moment in front of Judge Moss. We knew full well, based upon the Sinclair case, that immediate possession was going to be granted. So the purpose of the immediate possession hearing, the expedited proceeding, was to make sure the record was clear what Johnstown had done prior to the immediate possession hearing, not to convince Judge Moss, but to set the record. We knew from the Sinclair case that possession was going to be granted. But that's the second compelling point on good faith in this case, is that the town used an expedited proceeding to get immediate possession on the assertion of that need at that moment in August of 08, and then didn't use it.
Well, Mr. Dean, how is that distinguishable from, I think it was the Wall case, where there was kind of an offer just to purchase, or a condemnation for, I think it was a road, and then they made it a shopping center. And the court said that's just fine. I mean, and so I'm not, how do you distinguish Wall from this case? And the other case I'm curious about is Holyoke, which as I read it just says there has to be a good faith final offer and to give you sufficient time to respond. Don't we have those facts?
You do not have a good faith final offer.
You told
when they say the property is worth $50,000 and they offer $44,000, how can that possibly be a good faith offer?
But you said the chronology was first they made the final offer, right? Then I guess there was an intermediary. Is that right?
No, the intermediary was in the process to begin with.
All right. So you have an intermediary and you're negotiating back and forth, and they say our final offer is $44,000. And then, okay, we got a petition later, but why does that not get you there? Why does that not meet the requirement of Holyoke?
Because they knew the property was worth $50,000. Because that's what their petition alleged.
Well, but their appraiser, the city of Johnstown's appraiser, comes in with a number of $44,000, and that is presented at the immediate possession hearing. Doesn't that justify the offer of $44,000?
No, it does not. The $44,000 offer was for an exclusive easement with warranty of title, restriction on surface use, and not restricted underground sewer burial. It was not. That, by the time the immediate possession hearing ended, true, we had it narrowed down to what Johnstown was willing to admit it actually needed, which was an underground line for a sewer.
So what you're arguing is that before the hearing commenced, there was a demand for an exclusive utility easement. You didn't know whether it was above ground or below ground. After the hearing was concluded, you realized, no, they wanted underground, and we've got some evidence of $44,000. Now, the good faith discussion, though, isn't there throughout the materials here, including in the appraisal, an indication that this was to be an underground sanitary sewer?
Initial use was going to be for an underground sanitary sewer, no question about that, but that was not the easement that was being acquired. The appraiser did not appraise the easement that was demanded in the course of the good faith negotiations. He appraised what he thought Johnstown actually needed, that is, to limit it to a buried sewer line.
Which brings me back to Judge Boris's question. If this is a question of fact as opposed to a question of law, the good faith, isn't there evidence in the record to support the court's finding that there was good faith?
No.
Some evidence?
No. Not when the petition alleges $50,000 for an exclusive, above-surface, unrestricted use of utility easement, and they offer $44,000 for it. That is evidence of bad faith. It is not a question of fact. A matter of law, you cannot offer $44,000 for something you admit is worth $50,000. It just isn't good faith. Secondly, they did not need immediate possession because they did not use immediate possession.
Well, that's after the fact again. That's some months later. How you determine good faith at the time of the commencement of the action? We can't take into consideration, nor could the trial court, what happened months or a year afterward, can we?
Yes. I say you can measure.
What's the case that says we can do that?
That I cannot give you.
And on that, distinguish again, I'll ask you to distinguish Wall for me, because I think Wall would be exactly analogous to what you're saying. In Wall, there was condemnation, as I recall it, to build a road. The day after, the condemnation's done, pay the money, they say, oh, we're going to make it a shopping center. And the other side argues bad faith, and the court said, no problem.
Right.
How do you distinguish that?
Because that had not been limited to a specific use, and therefore, once condemned, it can be changed.
Sure it was. There was condemnation for the road.
That's right.
So that's limited to the specific use, and the idea is, once they bought it, they could do what they want with it. How is that distinguishable?
So did they offer a price which was what they thought it was worth, or did they offer 80% of it?
Well, they offered a price for the road and what they said it was worth, and then the facts change after. It seems to me you're arguing precisely the same thing. They offered here for, certain easement, and you're saying we had bait and switch, I guess is your argument, and the easement changed and the value changed after negotiations.
The value did not change after negotiations. They never offered anything other than $44,000 when they demanded an exclusive easement for full utility use above surface as well as underground, and then alleged in their petition that it was worth 50 grand.
Did you ask them how they got to the 50 grand in discovery or at any
point? I did not.
Is there any evidence in the record or suggestion where the 50 came from?
There is not.
Okay.
There is not. And the last, if Bernie Madoff had gotten his first dollar legitimately, would we be allowed to suggest that at some point his scheme turned fraudulent because of the way he conducted his business afterwards? I think yes. I think we do blame Bernie Madoff for having been a scam artist to begin with, based upon the conduct in which he engaged after he took his first dollar. And I submit in this case, you have more evidence of bad faith when you have the condemning authority say, our appraiser gets to use subdivided properties as comparables, but the landowner doesn't get to use subdivided properties as comparables. Our appraiser gets to use condemned easements to justify his 50% discount, but the landowner doesn't get to use the possibility of condemnation influencing a land transaction as a comparable. There are six other examples of the way the rules were applied by the trial court as advocated by the town to allow one thing for their witness and deny the same premise to the landowner in this case. We had the benefit of the Sinclair decision. We knew how Judge Moss was going to rule. We conformed the property owner's opinion testimony to what Judge Moss said he wanted in Sinclair. He denied the property owner, same property owner, same judge, same appraiser. He denied the property owner the right to testify, so we had the property owner prepared to testify in accordance with Judge Moss's ruling, even though the case was on appeal. And then he found other reasons to deny the admissibility of the owner's opinion of evidence. I can understand you granting dispensation to a trial judge who has a bad day, but I think you have a systemic problem here in Well County that property owners will be denied the right to testify so that a valuation by a jury can be avoided. I think you need to reverse that. I think you need to compel the town of Johnstown to get this case in front of the Supreme Court so they can answer this question with both sides of the case coming to them, one in favor of the property owner, one in favor of the condemning authority.
Mr. Dean, I had a couple of questions. You may want to reserve some time for rebuttal, so
yes.
Make it quick. And I will tell you, I have some issues with what the judge did on your client and the requirements of disclosures, and we'll ask your colleague about that. But let me, if I can focus you on this issue about the lost profit from the annexation. I'm not sure I'm following your argument as to why that is not speculation. I have some concern about that.
Fair question. It is not lost profit. It's lost property value.
I'm sorry. Correct.
And this is the straw that broke the camel's back. Once you've created an X across this 100 acres of property, you've got nothing commercially left to deal with. You've got to deal with Sinclair, and you've got to deal with a cross line from Johnstown. The property owner tried to move both lines to the property edge so they could make full use of the land. This was the final taking.
So is your argument that it couldn't be developed because the pipeline runs down the middle? Or is it, or how does that fit with the argument about annexation? Because the annexation argument, as I understand it, you got about three levels of conditions. First, you had to agree to annex it or not, then you had to agree to something else, and then something else. I can understand that latter argument to get to a place where you'd say it's speculation. Now it seems to me you're making a different argument. Your property is, you can't do anything with it because you got a pipeline down the middle. But maybe I'm misunderstanding.
You can't develop under county regulations because the sewer line is within 400 feet of the principal developable areas of the ground, and you can't get sewer service without annexing. Johnstown doesn't have the power to force annexation, but they effectively have done so because you can't do anything with the land unless you annex, that's the loss.
It's up to your client as to whether they choose to annex or not.
Yeah, but it wasn't before they took the line. My client had the option.
Okay, but ultimately,
had choices.
Before or after, it's your client's decision, and they've said, we're not going to annex, therefore we have this problem. Am I misunderstanding?
You are misunderstanding. Before they ran the sewer line, we had the option. We don't have the option anymore, period. We can use it as farm, or we can yield to whatever cost Johnstown wants to impose upon us, which might just coincidentally be a dedication of the sewer line, as in Palese. Thank you for your attention.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Robert Russell Anson, number 5672. I am representing the town of Johnstown, who is the appellee in this case. I think the primary issue in this case, which was not thoroughly argued in the actual briefs that were submitted to the court, was the judge's order itself, which issued a directed verdict, first of all, and then it used the evidence that was provided at the immediate possession hearing to make a determination of what the judgment should be. And a quick answer to the respondent's issues on the easement and the value, there was a final offer that had the $44,000, and the initial offer was a little high. But what isn't in the record, actually what happened is that the
Mr. Anson, don't go beyond the record.
I won't go beyond the record then. But the final offer was $44,300.
So would you respond to Mr. Dean's argument then about the $50,000 in the petition? I was a little puzzled by that myself, to be honest. How do you go from an offer of $44,000 before as your final offer and then have a petition that says $50,000?
Be honest with you now offhand, because I caught me off guard, because I don't remember that exactly happened, but it must be in the petition. I don't remember it being that way. However, the key point to the whole proceeding is the fact that as Mr. The counsel's argument here regarding the differences in the easement itself, he's talking about two different types of issues, because when you use an easement and to determine the valuation, it is the legal description of the easement itself, the property that's being acquired, not the use that's being put on the property. He's confusing the use of the property for a sewer line versus what was originally estimated as a exclusive utility easement versus an easement description, which never changed.
Let me ask you the same question we asked your opponent. Is good faith a question of fact or a question of law?
It could be a combination of both, because initially it's a question of law for the court to determine whether or not there was good faith negotiations. The good faith negotiations depends on the facts in the case, what occurred leading up to filing of the petition. There must be some negotiation that happened before that. Negotiation did happen in this case because there were offers that were made by the town of Johnstown to the Larsons in writing. We did use a professional negotiator to do that. However, there wasn't any formal response. There was no response that accepted it. The question comes down to this. If you issue an offer and it's not accepted or formally rejected, then it's assumed that it's rejected because no action is taken by the property owner. At a point in time, when after that happens with a reasonable period of time, you have the ability to file your petition to get acquisition to the property.
Let me ask you, Mr. Hansen, if I can, and this really goes to the, what's the legal standard, what do you view as the legal standard for good faith? Is it your view that in a case like this where there's an intermediary, you know, appointed or hired by the parties, that once you've made the offer and you say this is our you know, best and final offer, and they don't respond, or and you give them sufficient time to respond, is that enough? And second part, does it change anything if hypothetically, say, your best offer is 44, then ultimately you file a petition and say the value is 100, is that evidence of bad faith? So it's two pieces. What's required for good faith? Is it good enough just to have pre-petition negotiations and say this is our best and final, you got 3 weeks to respond? Is that end of it good enough? Or do we also look at what happens after? And if we look at what happens after, what do we make of the facts and the hypo I gave you?
Our good faith negotiations, you look at the facts that happen up to the time that the petition is actually filed. That is the key point. When the petition is filed, were there good faith negotiations before that point in time? And if an offer is made to the property owner and the property owner ignores the offer, takes no action, makes no response, then good faith negotiations have occurred. Then the petitioner can file his petition for acquisition of the property.
Right. And does it become then irrelevant if you claim a higher amount in the petition? That's Mr. Dean's argument, as I understand it. You had all these negotiations, your claim were good faith, but then when you file the petition, it's a whole nother number. Take an extreme example. You offer $44,000, and then in a petition you say the property's $200,000. Is that at least evidence of bad faith or no?
I don't think it's evidence of bad faith as far as going forward with the petition. It may be considered, if you look backwards, if it's a substantial difference such as $100,000, that would be up to the trial court to make a determination based upon all the facts that are presented to the trial court as to whether or not there were actually good faith negotiations.
So at what point do you reach a substantial difference? You say that the trial court can look at it if there's a substantial difference, but at what point would that be?
That's hard to determine. Again, it depends on the facts. If it's a substantial difference, $100,000 versus $44,000 or $50,000, that sounds pretty substantial because you're talking about double the amount.
15% is not?
It depends on the, again, upon all the facts involved in the case, on how much that difference would be and how it affects it. But the law indicates there are good faith negotiations predecessor to actually filing the petition itself. So that's what the court has to examine, is what happened before the filing of the petition. Were there good faith negotiations there?
Mr. Anson, can I ask you, and I may display some ignorance here, so I apologize in advance for that. Was there any discussion about this, you know, before the trial court, about this distinction between 50 in the petition and 44? Was that litigated at all? I'm just not remembering.
I don't remember the numbers being litigated. What was actually litigated was the question as to whether or not there was an amendment to the petition because of the fact of the stipulation at the media possession hearing to the fact that this was going to be a underground sewer line.
No, I think that's clear, Mr. Anson, but so I'm making sure you and I are tracking. Best of your knowledge, you don't remember any discussion about this 44 versus 50, bless you, the 44 versus the 50 issue?
No, I do not. There were questions about good faith negotiations, but I don't remember that issue being discussed at all.
Okay, thanks.
Mr. I'm sorry.
I was going to shift gears here and ask you about some of the evidentiary issues. I take it that the trial court excluded or struck the landowner's testimony because of failures to disclose, and I was wondering what authority you have that a person testifying as a lay witness needs to disclose the foundation for their lay opinion.
Actually, what happened, the evidence that was presented by the landowner at the final hearing before the jury was excluded because it wasn't meeting the standards for admission of evidence.
Well, there were numerous objections that you made going forward. Some of them related to lack of disclosure. Ultimately, didn't the trial court come down and say the fact that Mr. Larson's testimony wasn't disclosed, that was the key point that precluded his testimony from being admissible?
If I remember correctly, the key point was the fact that there wasn't any admissible evidence based upon the standards that you must have a ground that is shown for admission of that evidence, and then it must be relevant, and it must be based upon proper circumstances.
Well, we have a statute in Colorado that says that any witness in any proceeding can testify about valuation if they've done their homework, so to speak.
That is correct.
If they've talked to the buyer or the seller, or they've looked at the records, they can say that this is indeed the amount.
Yes.
What in Mr. Larson's foundational testimony does not meet that standard?
Number one, first of all, he was going to just throw out a figure that says it's worth $8 million. And
which he did, and then the trial court said lay some more foundation. So he went back and talked about all these people and these sales, didn't he?
There was, at one point, he did talk about, he threw out two or three different names of people he knows that completed sales that were for more than what we were offering.
Why isn't that enough?
Because, number one, it wasn't proper disclosure. It had never up until that point been disclosed to our side, to the town of Johnstown.
Why does it have to be? He's a lay witness. He's not an expert. In fact, you got an order in limine precluding him from testifying as an expert. So what has to be disclosed?
What has to be disclosed is the very issue of what properties is he talking about, because that was not disclosed. There's no opportunity for the town of Johnstown to develop and look at those properties to make any decision as to whether or not they're proper comparables. There's no opportunity for the court to even make a decision as to whether or not there's proper comparables.
But that's a rule of law. What rule of law, Rule 26, another statute, a case, specifically says that he must disclose that information?
Yes.
What? Which one?
Oh, I thought it was Rule 37. I'm just saying it
off. Rule 37 says if you don't disclose under Rule 26, you can preclude the testimony. Rule 26 says nothing about disclosing lay witness testimony. It just says list the person who's going to testify, and that was concededly done here. What part of Rule 26 is it that precludes him from testifying as a lay witness?
He's not precluded from testifying as a lay witness, but presenting that specific properties where he just voices out that these properties are comparables without any opportunity, because the first time it's ever mentioned is really at this trial, the evidentiary hearing, never before. It's a fundamental position of fairness.
But the law says he has to say it before trial, disclose it to you before trial. That's what I'm struggling with here. I can't find any provision of the law that says the other side has to tell you what the lay witness is going to testify to. You can take his deposition, which I think you did, and find out and say what's the foundation for your opinion on value. But what else is there? I haven't seen anything. In fact, your brief didn't even respond to this argument. I saw nothing in your brief that pointed us to a rule of law that says he must disclose something. There's nothing there that I can find. If you can enlighten me, I'd appreciate it.
I don't know offhand what specific law requires that to be done at that point in time. And I honestly don't know. If after this hearing I were to find some law, I'd be more than happy to submit that to the court as supplemental authority. But offhand, I do not know. And I'm relying on the court's decision and the arguments we made at that time. And I think the court made a proper decision because it was based upon the only evidence that the court can consider, the only appropriate evidence, which the court has the authority to do so. The only valid evidence regarding the value of the property was that at the immediate possession hearing, the testimony of the Johnstown expert, the appraiser, and for the value that the property was appraised at. And then, therefore, I think I'm asking this court to affirm that decision of the trial court.
Mr. Anson, I just have one other question before you sit down, if I could. On this, the argument that Mr. Dean makes about an amended taking. As I understand it, the amendments were the taking was limited to a sewer line, no other utility, the line would be underground, the taking would be without restrictions on surface use, and there was no warranty of title required, if my notes were right about what he was arguing changed. And I guess I'm trying to figure out, your argument, of course, is they were not any substantial, a substantial amendment to anything. I'm curious, you know, why do you say that? And what? How much do we need before we say that there is an amendment? And maybe your argument is none of these things change the value at all. But I'm curious if you would address that issue, please.
The question is that is the valuation of the property to be taken. That is the decision to be made through this whole process, the valuation of the property to be taken. The description of the property to be taken never changed throughout the whole proceedings. It was always the same. It was always an easement of a specific description. The description, or let's put it this way, that stipulation addressed during the immediate possession hearing had to do with the use of the property. That's all it had to do with, not a description of the property, not what property was to be taken. But when you make a valuation of the property under statute, you value the property taken as compared to other comparable properties, but just the property that is taken, which is this easement, not the use of the property.
But I know your time's up. Isn't the use relevant? The potential use, you look at highest and best use when you value the property.
The only possibility that it might be relevant is to whether or not the use of the property, or what exists on the property, the use, affects residual value of the balance of the property, not to the actual property taken.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you both for your arguments this morning. The case will stand submitted. We'll get you a written opinion in due course. That concludes the docket this morning. We'll be in recess. The bailiff may announce it.